Today on Vox Talks, is zombie lending by European banks leading Europe's economy into a dead end? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. The European banking sector largely survived the global crises of the last 12 years, but at what cost? Did government interventions and unconventional monetary policy give the banking sector time to recapitalise and revive Europe's economy, or merely kick the restructuring can down the road? In a new CEPR discussion paper, and a lot of other papers to be fair in the last few years, Virella Charia of the Stern School at NYU, he's also a CEPR fellow, has consistently argued that one of the reasons for sluggish growth in the euro area is that accommodative monetary policy has created effects in both the banking sector and the real economy that are the opposite of what was intended. Well, Virella joins me today. Welcome to Vox Talks.
Thank you, Tim. It's my pleasure to be here, and I look forward to the conversation with you.
Well, take us back, first of all, to the crises of 2008-2012 in the euro area. At the time, there was action taken to rescue the banking sector, and it was quite decisive action, wasn't it? Can you remind us what happened?
Yes, Tim. So, as we all know, the housing crisis fell pretty hard on the US banks as well as the European banks. Some of the European banks were locally exposed to housing bubbles, such as in Spain, for example, whereas even countries that did not have their own housing bubbles and busts, many were exposed to the housing markets in the United States in a very big way. Whichever way the shock hit them, in many parts of Europe, banks' capitalization was at risk because of the huge rise in the mortgage delinquencies, or if they had purchased mortgage-backed assets, then because of losses on these assets. What I'm trying to say is that even though the United States was the epicenter of the housing crisis, the vibrations from the earthquake that occurred in 07-08 in terms of a financial catastrophe spread very directly through exposures of these European banks. Now, the question is, was the recapitalization drive or the stabilization drive for the financial sector that ensued truly decisive? I try to answer this question in joint work with Sasha Stefan, Leah Brockert, and Maximilian Jaeger in one of my recent papers, which is titled Kicking the Can Down the Road. And so you can imagine where I'm going with this. What we show is that the scale of the support was large, but it was not always in the form of direct recapitalizations of the distressed banks. In many cases, the support was provided either through direct or indirect loan guarantees or liability guarantees, but that did not necessarily shore up the capital base, the equity capital base, which is the first absorbing loss buffer and which gives banks the capacity to continue intermediation going forward, because if you can't bear losses, it's hard for you to make new originations in wherever the demand is in the economy. Essentially, the scale of the European support was deceptive. When you broke it up into decisive recapitalization versus decisive guarantees or simply liquidity support from the central bank, in many countries, the support was more of the latter type rather than decisive recapitalization. 2 points here. First, countries that were fiscally stretched in terms of already having high debt to GDP numbers, having poor tax collections, maybe more reliant on foreign borrowings rather than domestic borrowings because of their high indebtedness. These were the countries where the support was not in the form of recapitalizations. They did not want to make the tough fiscal adjustments. They resorted more to kicking the can down the road by saying, oh, we will just paper over the losses. We will guarantee them, but let's worry about these guarantees when they really come to fruition. What this meant was that several parts of banking sectors in Europe were left in fairly fragile condition, I would say weak condition, even after the so-called cleanup. The second point I want to stress is that these were the banks that during 2009 to 2012, let's call it like the recovery phase after the global financial crisis, these were the banks that really struggled to continue intermediating in a healthy manner. And so what we find is that they found it hard to lend to more risky borrowers because what they were focused on was to not recognize the losses on their balance sheets. They were very keen to evergreen or continue the rollovers of their really stretched and distressed debts. They did not want weak firms to default on their loans because that would force a capital write-down. They might have to go to capital markets to raise equity issuances that might cost bank managers and CEOs their jobs, cause losses to shareholders. And as I said, the government capital in terms of a backstop wasn't coming either. So you essentially started seeing the first seeds of a prolonged slowdown of the style that Japan had in the 90s, which is that you are lending to zombie firms. You're zombifying the economy because rather than financial sector providing resources to new firms, to healthier sectors, to healthier firms in a sector, instead, the financial sector is focused intently on its legacy assets and ensuring that they don't have to recognize losses on these assets. Mm. And this is a less appreciated point because many economists like to think that because the package looked so large, everything was fine actually until the European sovereign debt crisis blew up. They think that was the turning point. And our main thesis is that no, actually the seeds of the financial sector instability in Europe were sowed right after the global financial crisis, where Europe, unlike the United States might have had bigger and more spectacular failures, but it was more decisive in recapitalization of its banks, recapitalization of its households through mortgage write-downs. In contrast, Europe took a little bit of the Japanese approach initially, and eventually, as I'll talk later, a lot more, and simply kicked the can down the road. It adopted different forms of regulatory forbearances so that banks didn't recognize the losses. And in any case, the banks on the one hand were getting liquidity from the central bank, but they really didn't have the capital in their balance sheet to make the right decisions. And that's really a bad combination. When you are giving funding to an intermediary, but they intermediate to the worst parts of the economy, I think that's much worse than actually a bank failure, in my view, because a bank failure very often crystallizes action to repair the system. In fact, I've often had this thesis that if there were spectacular bank failures in Europe as they were in the United States, I'm not wishing for them, but I'm saying if they were, perhaps Europe might have also reacted politically in a more decisive way to cleaning up the banking system.
But if you go back 10 years, a lot of people thought that what was being done in Europe was very good policy. Were you suspicious of it even then?
Absolutely. Some of this research was started right after the global financial crisis. We were a bit stunned that, you know, some countries were actually not taking decisive steps to fix their banking sector. And a lot of this came to light, especially as the 2010 and 11 sovereign stress in the GIPS, the so-called GIPS countries, Greece, Ireland, Italy, Portugal, and Spain picked up. And in a follow-up paper with Sasha Stefan, what we showed was that the undercapitalization of the banks post the global financial crisis had another unintended consequence that for a while actually looked to hide the true problems of the sovereigns. So what is this unintended consequence? Sasha, Stefan, and I called it the greatest carry trade ever, which is that when a bank is undercapitalized, one way that it can look for making quick gains is by investing in risky sovereign debt of its own country. Mm. Why is that? Because in Europe, across the Eurozone, sovereign debt bond holdings of banks require no additional capital requirement. So banks don't have to add any capital, even if they are undercapitalized or stressed on capital. As long as they have access to funding, and this could be through deposits because of deposit insurance, or it could be because the central bank is lending against a larger pool of collateral, as the European Central Bank increasingly was through its various repo facilities. So what is the carry trade? The carry trade is that you borrow short term in the markets. It could be wholesale funding or insured deposits, as I said, whatever you are able to get your hands on to. And then you go and buy long-term risky government bonds. So you will not buy bonds of Germany, you will not buy bonds of France, but you will go and buy bonds of the GIPS countries who are getting progressively vulnerable during 2010-2011 as the growth pickup didn't happen. And it's basically a bet that if all goes well, there will be convergence in the Eurozone. These bonds will move closer to the yields of the German bunds and we'll make a killing because we bought them at higher yields. However, if things don't work out well, then the bank goes bust, but it didn't have much capital of its own invested in all these trades to start with. So we'll fall on the taxpayer, so be it. But this is a great way for us to gamble for resurrection and try and come out of the undercapitalization situation. In the short run, what this does is that it creates an extra demand for sovereign debt. And so the sovereign bond yields don't reflect the true solvency condition of the sovereign balance sheet because banks have, undercapitalized banks have this gambling for resurrection or search for yield desire. And in fact, Sasha and I showed that it is precisely the banks that were weak on the capital front that engaged more in this sort of carry trade behavior. And they went bad. Unfortunately, the convergence didn't happen. With the way the restructuring of the Greek debt was progressing, markets in fact got convinced that perhaps a centralized burden sharing wasn't in place and was unlikely to come in place for support of these other sovereigns. And so their yields diverged rather than converging. And all these carry trades essentially cost the bank balance sheets a lot of money. The US money market funds, where some of the short-term wholesale funding was raised, they started pulling out of the European banks. This actually hit with full fury when the European sovereign debt crisis reached its peak in 2011 and beginning of 2012. Usually, the cost of undercapitalized banks is thought of in the context of a credit crunch, which is that they won't intermediate enough to the right firms. And I think this is correct. But there is a mirror image of this, which is that while they are not lending to the right firms, they're actually lending to the wrong firms and they are lending too cheaply to highly indebted sovereigns. And so while on the one hand you have a credit crunch in parts of the economy, there is actually evergreening and perhaps even subsidized sovereign lending that's taking place. And I think what we saw in the next phase of Europe's, what I like to call as Europe's lost decade, at least for many countries, what we saw in the next phase was now a play out of the sovereign stress that came about.
Yes, because you make the argument that this zombie credit as a result of these ultra accommodative policies creates disinflation. What is the intuition here?
That's right, Tim. And I think it's a great question because it is a bit counterintuitive, certainly counter to what the standard macroeconomic intuition is. So, yes. So if I could just roll back a little bit to the point where we were, which is that once the European sovereign debt crisis hit its peak, and given the lack of any fiscal sharing arrangements coming in place, of course, the European Central Bank stepped up its game and decided to be essentially a backstop of last resort for the euro as a whole. It wanted to give confidence to investors that the euro is not breaking up. You don't have to worry about countries leaving the eurozone. And it said, we'll do whatever it takes. We'll use our balance sheet to acquire all kinds of sovereign debt through outright monetary transactions. The shock and awe effect of this in July 2012 was quite strong. But again, what is a bit unnoticed is that while the government bonds did have a significant rallying right afterwards, carry trades were blowing up, and now the ECB's actions reversed some of the losses. But effectively, they only added about 10% of the capitalization to what banks already had. What you needed for a decisive recapitalization of the banking sector was a lot bigger. So these actions of the European Central Bank, the liquidity provision prior to the OMT announcement of Mario Draghi, and then the OMT proclamation, what they did was essentially to ensure that the government bond markets calmed down, but they did not fix the second part of the nexus, which was that the banks were actually quite undercapitalized to start with. they still had zombie lending incentives. In fact, when the money market run started on the banks in Europe, for a while there was market discipline, and the zombie lending for a period of one and a half year of that money market run was actually coming down, because banks were gradually trying to get back in shape. They didn't have access to easy funds. But in a way, the ECB stopped that problem. They said, no, we'll give you the funds. You do whatever it takes to keep lending to the economy. But because the bank's capitalization was not fixed, the money didn't go in the right places. The money actually went to evergreening. How is this connected to inflation? Normally, when a central bank undertakes accommodative actions, either it cuts interest rates or does outright purchases in the market of government securities and injects liquidity into the banking balance sheets, the hope is that the credit creation that happens as a result of this will, one, create growth, and two, at the same time, as a result, restore inflation. So whatever disinflationary forces might have been at play because of some demand shock, the extension of credit will boost both growth and inflation as a result of central banks' monetary easing and liquidity injections. However, this hinges very crucially on an unstated assumption in the macro models that the pass-through of monetary policy through the financial sector is to the healthy firms of the economy. And what has not happened very well is this pass-through. That the pass-through has not happened to the healthy firms. It has happened at subsidized rates to the zombie firms, and either as a credit crunch or pass-through, but only at very higher rates to the healthier firms in the economy. Now, let's get back to what keeping zombie firms alive does. So, you know, the Schumpeterian idea of creative destruction is that if firms try to grow, they take risks, they make mistakes, they fold up. When they fold up, either the healthier firms acquire their capacity, and most likely some newer entrants with better technologies, lower costs, better human capital will enter the sector, and eventually over time, the productivity of the economy will be restored. When you keep zombie firms alive, you hurt both the healthy firms of the economy and you prevent the entry of new firms. Why? Because banks are unwilling to lend to healthy firms or to new firms. They really want to not recognize losses on the bad firms that you have. Second, when zombie firms are alive, even if a sector has had a serious demand shock, the supply doesn't adjust because the zombie firms simply remain out there. They have very short-term profit considerations rather than long-term value creation considerations. And therefore, they often try to sell their products at ultra-cheap prices. In fact, that was a time when I used to make a lot of trips between New York and Frankfurt for the European Systemic Risk Board meetings. And I always used to observe the stores of United Colors of Benetton, which is one of the zombie companies in our sample. And they would always be on sale. The question we ask, in this is joint work with Tim Isert, Matteo Cross, Signani, Christian Ufinger, and Christian Hirsch in a variety of different papers. The question we ask is, did it lead to zombie lending? And if it led to zombie lending, what was the impact on the healthy firms? What was the impact on inflation? And what we find throughout is that in country sectors, so let's say in Italy, in construction, or you know, it could be in certain parts of manufacturing in Spain, these sectors of these countries where the zombies were kept alive, you saw product prices that were 40 to 50 basis points lower, and in many cases, even lower by even more than that. The average was 40 to 50 basis points compared to the same sector in other parts of Europe, say in Germany or France or in UK. And this is a pretty powerful dynamic, because once the pricing power is not there with healthier firms of the economy, they don't want to make investments, because their margins are very tight. There's too much competition in the sector relative to the demand. Without the central bank support to the undercapitalized banks and their evergreening of the zombie firms, the zombie firms would exit. The profitable firms would perhaps acquire some of their capacity, consolidate in the sector, regain pricing power, make better investments, become more productive, hire human capital, and so on. But these have not happened. And this is opposite of the effect that monetary stimulus is supposed to have. One last point here, a standard argument that is given in favor of keeping zombies alive is that, oh, it helps keep jobs in place. And it's a very narrow partial equilibrium argument. It is not the case that when you keep zombies alive, they are actually growing employment. They are not, because they are actually quite unproductive and heavily debt-ridden to start with. The job creation capacity is actually with the healthier firms of the economy. That is where there would be more investments, better jobs, and higher productivity. And what you do by keeping zombie firms is to, it's sort of, to use the term, you make your economy look like the Japanese economy of the 90s, and you actually don't get growth and productivity coming out in spite of massive, massive monetary stimulus. That is the key point. Even if you have a massive monetary stimulus, growth doesn't pick up as well. Disinflationary pressures remain in play, and you, I call it a cul-de-sac for the accommodative monetary policy, which is if you don't have financial stability and you keep easing and keep pushing on that string along without thinking hard about where banks are lending, you get exactly the opposite of what you wanted to achieve. And if growth is low, inflation is low, and you don't have a financial stability perspective of macro, then you say, I need to accommodate even more. I need to keep pushing even more liquidity into the system to get credit going. I fear that this is a trap that Europe and the European Central Bank hasn't fully come out of even yet. And before even they could really resuscitate growth to acceptably healthy levels, we now find ourselves in the midst of COVID. That's the real cost.
And it sounds from what you're saying that you have good empirical evidence here to link the behavior of these zombie firms to disinflation and to the negative impacts on the better performing firms. You've been able to make that link.
Absolutely, at least to the best that the present data allow us to make this claim. I would acknowledge here that these are not questions where you get randomized controlled trials. You know, there's no way to actually conduct these sorts of experiments. These are necessarily general equilibrium effects. They are effects that arise because of interaction of the central bank, the markets, the banks, firms, and within each sector, the firms are affecting each other's decisions in a variety of ways. So one has to rely to an extent on theory. One has to rely on theoretical predictions and the kind of associations that would arise under a financial instability view of easy monetary policy with undercapitalized banks versus the standard channel of transmission, and you try to tease it out. What does help us is the specific European structure, which is that to a large extent, as I explained at the beginning, the undercapitalization problems have been localized more in some countries than others. And clearly, some sectors are not as tradable as others. And what I mean is that the impact of the firms is more in a local sense. And that creates a nice laboratory for us, because we can compare similar sectors in different parts of Europe based on the health of their banks. And in the end, this is how we pick up the impact on disinflation. So we are not making absolute disinflation points. Of course, we can convert our estimates into aggregate impacts. But our point is that the same sector in a part of Europe where the banking sector is healthy doesn't have as much disinflation as another sector in Europe where the banks are in fact unhealthy to start with. And therefore, there's a greater presence of zombie firms in those economies. It's also the wealth of the body of evidence. We look at not just disinflation as a direct outcome. We also look at slightly better measures of inflation in the form of markups, which account for labor costs and so on. We look at sales growth. We show that these sectors have higher sales growth, but at much lower prices. So these can't be sectors where the demand had necessarily entirely collapsed, because actually the sales growth of the sector as a whole is high. So it's not that disinflation is a proxy for weak demand. It's just that the supply is likely to be too high. We show that the entry is actually not as vibrant in sectors where there are higher zombies. And then we look at the metrics of the healthy firms. We find that the healthy firms are behaving as though they are getting more expensive credit, they are cutting back on their investments, and so on.
If we are heading down this cul-de-sac, there's a dead end ahead. In general, what policy reversals do we have to do so we can back out of it?
It's a great question, Tim, and I'm glad you asked it, because we have been trying to make a recommendation in a variety of ways. A bunch of academics have been trying this over the last decade, which is to really get Europe to get its act together on the banking union. I think progress has been made. European Central Bank has become the single supervisory mechanism. It has reduced some of the falling through the cracks of supervision and bank underwriting and zombie lending standards. Some of this has been reined in. Nevertheless, there is still no clarity on burden sharing for deposit insurance. The single resolution mechanism has been put in place, but it's fair to say it has not been fully tested. But I think the burden sharing at the end is key. And there is two versions of it. One is that first and foremost, you have to accept that there is undercapitalization. If you simply stay in denial on this point, of course, it doesn't help. It is reflected most strikingly in the market-to-book ratios of the European banks. Market-to-book ratios of European banks are way short of the US counterparts. And again, there is the cross-country heterogeneity that I was referring to. So basically, there's a stock problem, which is that you have to restore the balance sheet strength of the banks right now, because we haven't fixed this problem of a decade long. And second, how will the burden sharing happen down the line? Because that is what will give confidence to investors, savers, and creditors of these banks, that if the banks were to go ahead, lend, and if growth didn't revive, that, you know, it should not create another meltdown in the banking sector. My view is that every country right now is in a difficult situation. Developed countries are fortunate to have better institutions and access to better lending conditions and terms than others. They should not squander this opportunity by ignoring the problems that have been left unaddressed. I think clearly certain amount of accommodation of firms during the impact of the COVID makes sense. However, I really hasten to add that this has to be a temporary stopgap measure. And when I say temporary, this has to be on the order of 3 months to 6 months max. I think beyond that, you have to realize that if the slowdown continues and you are in a situation where you are thinking about providing continued relief, even the balance sheets of the developed country sovereigns are going to get stretched. You can't really provide support for an entire year of lockdown or 6 months of lockdown. I think there will have to be some casualties, and it would be good to ensure that banks are in a position to accept the losses and not continue to evergreen them as zombie loans forever. Because while on the one hand, it may again seem very tempting, as it seemed tempting in 2009 and it seemed tempting in 2013 and 14, that, oh, we should just accommodate all the firms that are folding up because this way we preserve jobs. Europe, at the end of the day, needs to restore its overall productivity. And the only way out is that banks are healthy, firms are healthy, and banks lend to healthier firms at a cheaper rate than they lend to riskier firms, and that they don't lend to firms that are already very distressed or in a state of default. So I would say a European Central Bank, within a few months, which would already be 6 months after the outbreak of the COVID, Europe is in a much better situation on health front on COVID than many other countries. It should use this opportunity to make a decisive step towards fixing its banking sector and the institutional arrangements around it once and for all. I think it would strengthen the Eurozone. It would give greater confidence to investors. But most importantly, it will help restore productivity and innovation and channeling of financial capital to the right firms in the Eurozone.
Specifically, if I could put you in charge of the European Central Bank today, what's the first lever that you would pull to achieve that?
You put me in a tough spot, Tim, but I think I would say
Don't rule it out. It might happen yet.
I think the central bank can actually lead the way. It doesn't have to necessarily take the fiscal positions of the governments as given. I think the central bank has done its accommodation. I think it has accommodated banks on liquidity front. It has accommodated banks on asset quality front. And it is doing a massive quantitative easing along the lines of Bank of Japan. What it needs to do first and foremost is to start marking the bank balance sheets extremely well. It needs to do very serious stress tests on a regular basis. Clearly, the world has changed since COVID and the near-term uncertainties are many. I think a serious stress test would reveal which banks are likely to face higher capital pressures if growth doesn't pick up. That's exactly the stress one needs to consider at the present moment. And I think that these banks should either be recapitalized by their shareholders. If that is not possible, then they should be accelerated into the resolution regime if the national governments are not willing to recapitalize these banks. There is a third path which is not on table, and that's an institutional arrangement that a banking union, such as a common deposit insurance agency, would bring about, is prompt corrective action. In the United States, when a bank falls below a certain capital standard, it is basically subject to a lot of restrictions. And if it is a SIFI, a systemically important financial institution, then the Dodd-Frank Act creates all this possibility through stress tests of having capital contingency plans and, you know, creating a set of restrictions on these banks. So my sense is it's better to have an undercapitalized bank that's not receiving capital from anywhere to gracefully shrink over a period of time. At a minimum, they should not be allowed to continue doing the zombie lending, because that's just a complete waste of resource. In some ongoing work with Olivier Wang and Simone Lenzu, we are calling it a diabolical sort, which is that you get the worst firms being connected to the worst banks. And therefore, when the macro shocks hit, you get a very quick amplification of the problem. So I would say the European Central Bank can do its job most diligently with a single-minded focus on financial stability. If it does that, it will create pressure on the national governments to either sort out the deposit insurance union and or inject adequate capital into their banks so that credit remains healthy in their countries.
But this is probably the one time in the history of modern banking when problems like this might be considered to be second order problems. Do you think that anything is going to be done to fix the European banking sector seriously before 2021?
So I don't know at what level the present dialogue on financial stability stands, but let me offer the view that health shock like COVID is exactly the situation in which you really don't want financial instability. And let me explain that in a few minutes. What I mean is that it is a health shock at the end of the day. There will be some scars, lasting scars, because of some readjustments and reallocations that are happening in productive capacity of the economy. Nevertheless, if you take a 2-year or a 3-year horizon, most people's expectation is that the health curve on itself will be behind us. Okay, it could either be because we reach herd immunity or because some vaccines come along the way and essentially reduce the background risk of the pandemic regime. Now, do you really want an unstable, undercapitalized banking sector when that recovery point is reached? What would be the best outcome when we get there? The best outcome when we reach that point would be that the tremendous burden that the public exchequers have taken on, especially in the developed markets, to support the economy in this quote-unquote coma stage, that this burden can actually be resolved relatively swiftly so that, you know, the fiscal burden doesn't lead to repression either through high taxes or forced buying of government bonds by banks and so on. For that, you need good growth when we are at the point of recovery. For a good growth, we will need efficient financial intermediation. And for that, we are going to need healthy banking sectors and more generally, even financial sectors beyond banks. So in my opinion, it would be extremely short-sighted to say this is the time to ignore financial stability. This is the time to let banks make whatever kind of loans they make. This is the time to take on zombie lending left, right, and center. I can understand it for a short period of time, as I had said, 3 months, max 6 months since the outbreak of COVID. But beyond that, you have to get ready to prepare the balance sheets of the financial sector, not just so that they can withstand the stress if 2 years is not the time when a recovery happens, it becomes protracted. Or if the recovery happens, they are in a shape to aid the recovery to the fullest. So I think it's a very counter view to what some of the economists are saying right now. They are too focused on the narrow aspects. And I think they are not entertaining the counterfactual enough. You can see that even economies where lockdowns have not been introduced, they have had massive collapse of economic activity. And that's because individuals beyond a certain peaking of the health curve don't want to step out themselves to the extent that they can make that life versus livelihood choice. I think the temporary pain is given. I think what would be a misguided step is that while fixing what is relatively likely to be contained in time, which is the immediate impact of the pandemic, that you skew the initial conditions of the economy for the post-pandemic recovery phase. Because in a way, that's a much, much longer term than the immediate 1 or 2 years. And I think especially given that there has already been a lost decade, in my opinion, in terms of the growth potential being attained in Eurozone, I think this could be a very useful time to put in place the right structural measures. I would start the process right away so that in 12 to 18 months' time, there is a deposit insurance in place, there's a burden sharing arrangement in place, there's a prompt corrective action in place, stress tests are being done, and national governments are being told either you recapitalize your banks to our stress test levels, or, you know, either privately or publicly, or we will have to subject them to graceful shrinking, because we need Europe to recover well so that the great amounts of public debt that have been taken on can be repaid. And, you know, Europe is showing signs of solidarity over these past few weeks, right? And I think that gives me hope that the solidarity is not just on the dimension of making the investments at national levels for growth to restart and for temporary support measures. I think solidarity also needs to come together for ensuring that financial stability concerns for Eurozone are fixed once and for all. Even if they don't go all the way to a fiscal union, if they can complete the steps towards banking union, it would be a far better currency union than the fractured outcomes it has had over the past 15 years.
Well, maybe we can listen back to this in 12 months' time and see what has happened. But meanwhile, Viral, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim. It was an extremely engaging conversation, and I encourage the listeners to look at the papers that Tim will shortly give them a rundown on.
You know what I'm about to do. So I'm going to list some papers, and then Viral, maybe you can tell me if I've missed anything out. For 2020, the most relevant paper probably for today is the one that Viral mentioned, Kicking the Can Down the Road, Government Interventions in the European Banking Sector, authors Acharya, Borchert, Jaeger and Stefan, and that is CEPR discussion paper 15009. Other papers, 2020, Zombie Credit and Disinflation, Evidence from Europe, authors Acharya, Crossignani, Isert and Ufinger from 2019, Whatever It Takes, The Real Effects of Unconventional Monetary Policy, authors Acharya, Isert, Ufinger and Hirsch, and that was published in the Review of Financial Studies. Also 2019, Does the Lack of Financial Stability Impair the Transmission of Monetary Policy? That authors Acharya, MBA, Gerovitz, Stefan and Teichmann, and 2014, going back some way there, The Greatest Carry Trade Ever, as discussed in this podcast, Understanding Eurozone Bank Risks, and that was Acharya and Stefan. Did I get them all?
Oh, that's a good list. I did write a couple of Vox EU pieces around these papers, especially on the cul-de-sac view of accommodative monetary policy in midst of financial instability. So the readers might find that a good summary of some of these research as well.
You have to read them all. There will be a test before the podcast next week. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week, so subscribe to Vox Talks and you will never miss an episode. And remember, you can find 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.